Hello, everybody, and welcome to Season 5 of the Common Grounds Unity Podcast. Jesus valued unity and prayed for it. We believe unity begins with Jesus-centered relationships, gathering around a table, sharing a cup of coffee or a meal. We like to say unity begins with a cup of coffee. So grab a cup and let's get started with another episode of the Common Grounds Unity Podcast. Well, welcome to another conversation on the Common Grounds Unity Podcast. I'm Kevin Witham, and this is our 170th podcast. And today, we're thrilled to have Dr. Richard Beck with us to discuss his book, The Shape of Joy. Also joining us is Dr. Claire Davidson Frederick, who is the director of the Saunders Center for Joy and Human Flourishing at Abilene Christian University. In this podcast, Dr. Frederick will be functioning more as a co-host than guest, as she's one of the most informed people about Dr. Beck's book, The Shape of Joy. In the next podcast, her work with the Saunders Center is going to take center stage, and we're going to have a discussion about that. So I'm here with my co-host, Drew Baker. Drew, it's good to be back with you today and good to share in this conversation with you.
Yes, I've been eagerly looking forward to co-hosting with you again. It's been too long. We've kind of been doing different ones, alternating, but we don't get to do it together. So
yeah, always great to work together.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and introduce Dr. Richard Beck. He is professor of psychology and a senior fellow of the Saunders Center for Joy and Human Flourishing, which will be the topic of the next episode, and that's at Abilene Christian University. Outside of the classroom, Richard travels the world as a sought-after speaker and award-winning blogger and author. Richard's most recent books are The Shape of Joy. That's today's conversation, talking about the transformative power of moving beyond yourself. He's also written Hunting Magic Eels, Recovering an Enchanted Faith in a Skeptical Age, Trains, Jesus, and Murder, The Gospel According to Johnny Cash. That sounds very fascinating. I haven't read that one. And Stranger God, Meeting Jesus in Disguise, which I have read and was very formative for me as well. Richard is married to Jana Beck, a high school theater teacher, and they have two sons, Brendan and Aiden. He is an elder and adult faith Bible class teacher for my mom at Highland Church of Christ and leads a weekly Bible class for 50 inmates at the Maximum Security French Robertson unit in Abilene, of which my mom is not a part. But anyway, welcome, Richard. How are you?
It's good to be with you. Thank you. Excited about the conversation we're going to have.
Well, you know, that the mention of that Johnny Cash book, one of my son's first introductions to you is we were watching the History Channel and you were on a documentary talking about Johnny Cash. And my son said, "Dad, isn't he a Church of Christ guy at Abilene Christian University?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, this is cool." So there's a whole nother side to your work that's fun to think about. We also want to introduce and give a good introduction to Claire Davidson Frederick. Dr. Frederick is the director of the Saunders Center for Joy and Human Flourishing at ACU. Before she started this position, she spent 8 years at Lipscomb University teaching in the College of Bible and Ministry and serving as program director for the Engage Youth Theology Initiative. Claire has degrees from Rutgers University, where she did her undergraduate work. She did her MDiv at Lipscomb University and received her DMin from McCormick Theological Seminary. Her doctoral project entitled Gathered with the Saints, Reimagining Worship in the Age of Coronavirus won the John Randall Hunt Prize for Outstanding DMin Thesis back in 2021. Her writings are also featured in Finding Their Voices, Sermons by Women in the Churches of Christ, ACU Press, going back to 2015, and then Women Serving God with John Mark Hicks in 2020. She's also written for Levin, a journal of Christian ministry, and you may subscribe to that journal. You can find some of her writings there. She also co-planted All Saints Church of Christ in 2016 and served as their liturgist and worship minister until she moved to Abilene. Before that, she served as a family minister at the Woodmont Hills Church in Nashville and was an accomplished singer and songwriter in the country music industry for 15 years. She is married to musician Kyle Frederick, has two daughters, one son-in-law, and three free-range grandkids. I like that description. Claire, welcome. We're so glad to have you with us for the first time on our podcast. And since you're most familiar with The Shape of Joy, I'd love for you to kick off this conversation with our first question. And first, just how are things where you are in Abilene? I guess both you and Richard are there. I hope it's a nice day there.
Beautiful day, and we're ready for the weekend. So getting that sunshine, and it's also sing-song weekend. So there's a lot of activity around here right now with the kids preparing for that. So I will ask this first question for The Shape of Joy. Richard, in your book and elsewhere, you observe that we are experiencing a mental health crisis among young people, particularly. Can you share what you've observed as a professor and why our current situation warrants the designation of crisis?
Yeah. I think this is something that a lot of people have been paying attention to. So that's not a novel insight of my own. I think study after study has been pointing to increasing rates of anxiety and depression among young people, increased rates of suicide risk. And it's also affecting older generations as well. Sociologists have started describing what they call deaths of despair. For many generational cohorts, American life expectancy had been increasing with every generation, but has recently decreased. And then as sociologists have looked at the decline in life expectancy, they noticed that it wasn't because of heart disease or cancer or dementia, but was because of these deaths of despair, increased suicide, increased overdose deaths, and increased deaths due to liver disease in relation to chronic alcoholism. So people are literally dying from despair or lack of hope. And so the Shape of Joy begins this conversation with that present mental health conversation.
Yeah, that knowledge of the current state of the mental health crisis, you have your finger on the pulse of that. And so you tell a great story of when you gave a graduation speech for your son's graduation, and you told them not to follow their dreams. And, you kind of self-deprecate there about being the worst graduation speech, but it may be not what they were looking for, but probably what they most needed to hear. So tell us, why is that don't follow your dreams an important message for people today?
Yeah. The introduction of the book is called the world's worst graduation speech. Yeah. And so I was invited to give the commencement address for my son's senior class, and began many commencement addresses. Hey, graduates, you can be anything you want to be, do anything you want to do, shoot for the stars, follow your dreams. But then I made a swerve and basically said, but if the psychological research is to be believed, your dreams will make you unhappy. And there's actually some scientific research on this, that we are actually pretty poor planners of what will make us happy. We set a course and think that this will career or life choice or move or will satisfy us at some deep level, and that people find themselves late in life unfulfilled. Is they climb the mountain and realize is this all there is? So I was being a little facetious, but really kind of speaking to a real phenomenon. But the point I wanted to make was to the graduates was, the day your dreams come true, nobody needs a lot of help on that day. The day that will really define your life is the worst day of your life. And so I put that in front of the graduates and I said, I'm not interested in the day your dreams come true. We will be there to celebrate and applaud. That'll be a great day. But the defining day of your life, your moment of truth, will be the worst day of your life. And everybody will have the worst day of their life. And the question on that day is, who are you on that day? Who are you in the face of divorce or job loss or a tragic diagnosis or an accident? Like on those days, what is going to help you carry through on those days? And so it's a conversation to set the stage about psychological resiliency. Do we have on that day the spiritual and psychological resources to carry us through some of those dark times?
Well, building on the contributions of Charles Taylor, you claim in the introduction of the book, transcendence is good for you. Happiness, joy, peace, meaning in life, psychological resiliency, and inner tranquility are achieved when we pivot away from the self to find rest in a transcendent reality that exists beyond ourselves. So you talk about in the book how those in pre-modern times understood themselves in relation to a transcendent reality, but that's no longer the case. You then trace for us in the book, and if you could just do this for our listeners, that kind of philosophical, psychological journey that brought us to this place where we are today. I think, you know, this is really helpful, I think, for us understanding how to connect with modern people. So could you just kind of trace that for our listeners?
Yeah, I describe it as the collapse of the self, that the modern self has become very inward-looking and self-referential. And you can describe how that happened in a lot of different ways. Some philosophers will point to the work of like a René Descartes. But in my discipline, it would be Sigmund Freud, the kind of the Freudian turn, where Sigmund Freud, famously an atheist, basically said, we don't need to orient and guide our lives and seek deep meaning or purpose through alignment with God or transcendence. But rather, he turned the modern world inward and basically said, you will find mental health and happiness. You will find a compass to orient your life by going inside of yourself, penetrating deep down into the unconscious and discovering, you know, your true self or your real self, and then using that self as a navigational tool. And so we were thrown inside of ourselves to find the secret of happiness. We were, but the trouble is that psychologists are now beginning to understand that excessive inwardness, that self-referentiality, is actually making us unhappy. And so there is now this concern in psychology that excessive introspection, and even the ways psychotherapy can contribute and exacerbate excessive introspection and rumination, now needs to be addressed. And so we need to start taking a step away from ourselves and turn outward to encounter a reality bigger than ourselves.
That's very helpful. That's helpful. Also, Richard, a key to joyful living is what Brené Brown calls shame resiliency. And her observation is that those who are the most shame resilient possess a single fundamental conviction, feeling worthy of love and belonging. So what are some ways that we have tried and failed to capture that feeling of being worthy of love and belonging?
Yeah. One finding that I talk about in the book, and I don't know if we'll get to this later on, but to kind of bring it up early, is that a lot of us have been trying to achieve, like I said, mental health through self-regard. This is the kind of self-esteem culture that we live in. And that, so if I can just look in the mirror and convince myself that I like myself, then that's the therapeutic path. And that's guided therapeutic culture. It's guided self-help conversations. It guides our parenting. It guides our coaching and our mentoring, that, you know, the instilling of self-esteem. But the trouble with self-esteem, as psychologists understand it, is that's a very variable metric. It's something that is more reflective of how our life is going rather than something that's pretty durable and steady. And so psychologists are contrasting self-esteem with what they're calling mattering. It goes by different names. Sometimes it's called cosmic mattering or existential significance. But it is this durable conviction that you matter no matter what, that your value and worth are unconditionally given to you and granted to you. And that's Brené Brown's idea, that when she did her research on shame resiliency, just kind of discovered that the only thing that separates the shame resilient from the people filled with shame was this conviction that you are worthy of love and belonging just because. Now, again, that is profound, but also ambiguous. Like, where is the source of that mattering to be grounded? And that's where I've been using this word transcendence. Christians would call that God, being a child of God. That's where that is grounded. So the Shape of Joy is raising this observation. Hey, psychologists have discovered scientifically, empirically, that people who have this conviction are healthier and happier. But then that raises, that science raises a religious question about the grounding of our value and our worth. So that's kind of the argument of the book. Where do we get that? Well, that's an interesting question. If you don't have a spiritual grounding, that might, your mattering might be kind of hanging out there in the air or flying in the wind and be vulnerable to the ups and downs of self-esteem culture.
Yeah. Or built upon completely faulty premises. Like in the beginning, you know, the outline of your book, and it talks at the beginning, is talking about that inward collapse or being curved mm-hmm. inward. The second book is, you know, shifting away from the ego, and we'll talk more about that. And then the third is being shaped outward. But in that first phrase, you talk about one of the ways we find our self-importance, our mattering, is through the superhero complex. And that was kind of surprising to me, because that took a different turn than I was expecting to see there. But it rings really true. Can you tell a little bit about what is this superhero complex, and how do you see it playing a major role in our political and what you call affective polarization? So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So when you're trying to, you know, achieve mental health through self-regard, the question is then, you know, through what metrics will you select to compare yourself to? And the psychologist Ernest Becker describes this as a hero complex. I call it a hero game. The superhero complex comes from a podcast in Seattle, Washington. People are like dressing up like Superman and Batman, like real life superheroes, and they were patrolling downtown Seattle to like stop crime. And there's a whole podcast your listeners can go. It's really interesting about, you know, why people were doing this. And I just kind of use the name of that podcast, The Superhero Complex, to say, you know, that seems really extreme to dress up like Superman and try to stop crime in your downtown neighborhoods. But we all are playing some game of significance. The games vary by person. I'm a professor, so I have a superhero complex that's tied up into my teacher evaluations and being successful my campus. Some of us have hobbies, some of us have interests. But one of the things that where I see us trying to achieve a heroic identity is politics. I think one of the things that's happening, reason why our political discourse has gotten so conflictual and hostile, is because as we kind of move into a deeper post-Christian culture, and that something has to be the receptacle of our most deeply held values and moral commitments. And if those values and moral commitments are not going to be faith, then something will carry that forward. And increasingly, I think our politics are becoming more religious, in the sense that my political affiliation represents who I am from a values perspective, from a moral perspective. And because of that, because politics have become increasingly moral and religious, then we're framing our political disputes in very highly moralized terms. It's not how do the different political parties balance or negotiate competing goods. You know, how do we solve an immigration crisis where we're a nation of immigrants, but we want to do that in an orderly and lawful process? Like, how do you balance that? We're not approaching that as a problem to solve, but rather as a moral posturing against good and evil on both sides of that. And that just kind of ramps up the conflict and the rhetoric. And so I would suggest that one of the reasons why politics has gotten so fraught is because it's carrying more existential weight for us. And so we can't see it pragmatically anymore. And it becomes more of an expression of identity and values, and even our religious commitments, the way we see politics and religion increasingly conflated. So that's just a side part of the book. It's just kind of putting that on people's radar screen that maybe the way we're trying to achieve a sense of heroic identity is engaging in these political fights like we see on the social media so often. There's some self-esteem thing at stake in those arguments that may be worth attending to. And if we could attend to them, maybe we could step back and be a little bit more charitable and generous in our listening towards each other.
I think that's really helpful and so relevant with where we are. Richard, you in the second part of your book, you give us this very striking description of the inwardly curved ego. And a quote from the book goes this way: "Our minds have become haunted houses with our thoughts gloomily wandering their lonely corridors like ghosts." So before we talk about how to alter the shape of the ego, give us just a real quick description of what is meant by ego.
Yeah, that's probably a term of, art, or in my discipline, the ego. Probably your listeners would describe it as like just yourself. It's just the subjective experience of you, yourself, your ego, right? Your the inner experience of your identity. And so when I see ego, I just mean you, your experience of yourself as a person, and how that experience has been increasingly a conversation of one, like you are in your head talking to yourself or listening to yourself more often, and trying to convince that self to like yourself, or you have negative thoughts and you're trying to beat back those negative thoughts with other thoughts. And again, this is that self-referentiality where we are in our heads wrestling with ourselves more and more.
And again, Richard, in the discussion of turning away, you describe six windows on the ego, or six ways of viewing the ego that can help us avoid the pathologies of modern life that you described in part one. Could you briefly introduce and unpack each of these six windows?
Yeah. Part two of the book is like, so if being entangled with the self is leading us to be increasingly unhappy and neurotic, then obviously the first thing we got to do is get a little distance from the self. And I use the surprising research on humility. That's a really hot topic right now in psychology. And that might be a surprise to people to find that humility is one of the keys that unlocks mental health. I don't think, especially if you're raised in conservative religious environments, humility sounds like humiliation, that humility is denigrating the ego, or trying to, if you get a big head, you got to kind of pop the balloon of your own narcissism or vanity. But as psychologists have investigated humility, what they've discovered is that humble people, they just aren't all that wrapped up in themselves. They're not in their heads a lot. They're not self-absorbed or self-focused. They're more outwardly focused. They're not, overly triggered by ego threats. And so they're just kind of comfortable in their own skin. There's a kind of a self-forgetfulness. So there's a quote that's attributed to C.S. Lewis. I don't think he said it, but it's attributed to him a lot, which is humility isn't thinking less of yourself. It's not denigrating yourself. It is rather just thinking about yourself less. So self-forgetfulness. So using that research on humility, I kind of say, well, what does it look like from the psychological research to kind of map out a healthy ego or a healthy self? And so I kind of have these six windows that describe, they overlap in many ways, but they kind of paint, I think, a holistic picture of somebody who is not wrapped up or overly entangled with their inner life. So one of them is like ego volume. The internal chatter in your head or conversation can be either loud or quiet, and healthy people have quiet egos. That allows them to be other focused. They're not self-focused, but they're other focused. That's the second one. Where's their focus? The third one is their ego investment. Are they self-absorbed? Or are they self-forgetful? So they're self-forgetful. Stability is how reactive they are to ego threats. And what I mean by an ego threat is like, if you step on the scale and you gain 5 pounds, does that like devastate you, right? That's an ego threat. if you, my students, if they get a B on a test, you know, does that spin them in a spiral of reactivity because they didn't get an A? Our students are competing in sing song, right? This, all the clubs are competing. And if they get second place, that's an ego threat. You know, if I, as an author, am watching my Amazon sales rankings go down and down and down, right? That's an ego threat. If you're a pastor and somebody sends you an email on Monday morning about what they didn't like about your sermon, like that's like ego threats, right? Like things that kind of in my superhero complex trigger me and cause me to kind of think, oh, I'm losing my game. A lot of us are really reactive to those. But a humble person is not as reactive. They're not as entangled in that superhero complex. And then the fifth one is, where does their value come from? Is it contingent or conditional upon those metrics of winning or losing? Or is it unconditional? We've talked about that already, that unconditional mattering or cosmic significance. And then the third one is just the size of the ego. In the literature on awe, psychologists are describing what's called the small self. And by small, they don't mean insignificant. They mean a part of a greater whole. A small self is a self that sees itself as connected in a relational way to a greater reality, towards other human beings, toward the natural world, and obviously to God. So those are the six kind of quick hits that I describe about that's kind of what a healthy ego should look like.
I was struck by how much as you talk about these, I mean, you're coming at it psychologically, and you do speak a lot to the Christian spiritual formation relation, but even before you made the point, I was just noticing so many similarities to, you know, like what you're talking about, that you know, where are you getting your valuation? And I'm mm-hmm. thinking of Henry Nouwen's social scaffolding, or the false self, and how it leads to this compulsive self that needs, you know, estimation from other people mm-hmm. to get our sense of self-worth. And then you get into you know, this tracing this journey in psychology from Freudian psychoanalysis to cognitive behavioral therapy to ACT, and I forgot what that stood for, but ACT, from what I understand, is very similar to centering prayer, of recognizing thoughts and releasing them, and just that mm-hmm. that act of releasing. So can you just take a little minute and talk about how these or what are some Christian practices that are really helpful in quieting the ego, and, you know, maybe make a case for why these practices aren't just Eastern mysticism, but why they're deeply Christian and helpful, not just for our psychological health, but spiritual well-being.
Yeah. So we're talking here about the research on what's called mindfulness. And if you're a part of wellness culture at all, like, this is just another, it's probably right up there with gratitude. But I'll argue that gratitude is also a practice of transcendence, what's called cosmic gratitude. Gratitude is the emotional response that we have to being given a gift or a favor. And what's interesting about that is in the New Testament, right? The word for grace, charis, is the word for gift. And so you could argue that the entire emotional realm of Christian practice is one of gratitude, receiving a gift or a reception. Cosmic gratitude is like, okay, somebody does me a favor and I feel thankful to that person, but who do we extend thanks to for, like, our life, for this next breath, for the gift of a sunrise, right? Like, where is that thanks addressed? And that's cosmic gratitude. And now, again, for religious people, we know exactly who that gratitude is directed towards. But I'm just kind of raising again that conversation about transcendence, because everybody experiences cosmic gratitude. But if you don't have a faith commitment, like, where is that going? Just out into the void? You know, where is that making contact with? But to come back to mindfulness, that's the other hot topic right now in the wellness culture. And mindfulness is just, again, we're learning that rather than it being inside your head, you need to get out of your head. And the simplest practice to do that is just to be mindful of your breath. Be mindful of the sights and the sounds around you, like listening to the bird song, being attentive to the things that are you're sitting around in the kitchen, tasting your coffee in the morning. And that practice, yes, goes back to meditational practices in Eastern religious traditions. And they are helpful because they do stop the self-referentiality. They do allow the mind to rest, and I would even argue heal from the lacerations of its own inner self-talk. There is a connection there with like contemplative prayer, where I am sitting in silence. I may attend to my breath. I may pick some language from the Christian faith tradition. And Claire is an expert on spiritual formation, so she can speak a lot to this with even more authority than I can. But like simple prayers like the Jesus prayer, you know, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy on me, a sinner, and saying that over and over again. The difference here between contemplative prayer or breath prayer, sometimes they're called arrow prayers, just one word that I say and I direct it up to God like an arrow of petition, is that in contemplative prayer, you are being addressed and you are listening to a voice. You go with an expectation of conversation. And because, again, contemplative prayer is reaching toward God. So it's not meditation. It's not just observing your thoughts and not clinging to those thoughts and letting them pass by as you would do in meditation. Now, to be clear, there is some of that contemplative prayer. Like, I can't hear God because I am thinking about myself. So there is a quieting of the mind, but it's not just to quiet the mind as a relaxation practice. And so that's one distinction I'd make. Mindfulness is just causing you to be mindful to your environment, but that environment is still inert. It's still just, I'm grounded, but I'm not in relationship with that world. Where prayer practices are causing me to be mindful to something outside of myself, but in expectation of hearing a voice and being addressed.
Thank you.
I can kind of take that a little bit further, talking about mindfulness. One of the things that struck me as you get towards the end of the book is you have these great paragraphs on love and how, you know, truly loving gets us outside of ourselves. And you make the comment in the book, and I just comment on this because mindfulness is so much in the conversation today. I was in the doctor's office not too long ago, and you know, my medical doctor was talking about the benefits of mindfulness. I've got a good friend that's thinking about a young person getting a degree in mindfulness, you know. But you also make the comment in the book that mindfulness has its limitations. There's a dark side to it because it can get us into ourselves and keep us from doing the hard work of love, which is so important to joy. Could you take us a little bit down that road and tell us what you mean by that?
Yeah. That's there's actually research on how mindfulness can actually not be helpful. One of the things that mindfulness is used for is getting rid of negative emotions. And so typically we're thinking of, you know, depressive rumination, anxiety, stress. So mindfulness is kind of used as a relaxation technique to get to kind of step away from negative emotional states. But some negative emotional states are calling you to the work of repair or the work of love. And so these are like emotions like guilt or shame, where I do something, I've hurt somebody, and I have these bad feelings about something I've just did. And those feelings are, you know, so in scripture we call this godly sorrow, right? Godly sorrow. So if I snap at Jana today, hopefully I have some negative emotions about my behavior, right? I feel bad about that. And that I should be a little haunted about that. And that's to prompt me to the work of what psychologists call social repair, otherwise known as apologizing, or the recovery community describes as making amends, right? If I break something, I need to fix it. I need to own it. I need to fix it. And that's not fun. It's not enjoyable. But so psychologists have done research on people who who practice mindfulness to free themselves from the negative feelings of guilt or shame don't engage in the act of social repair. So mindfulness actually can interfere with taking responsibility for your actions. And I think that's an important corrective when we look at things like mindfulness or contemplative prayer or even Sabbath practices that become co-opted by like self-care culture, and where I'm just using all of these things to bring myself to an inner state of calm or peace, where maybe I need to be a little bit, you know, agitated or disturbed in my soul, because I actually, and this is the point again, to move outward in acts of repair or love. Because as we know, love and self-care they rub up against each other. There's a sacrificial aspect to love, and it brings stress into my life because of my obligations and commitments. And learning how to bear with that suffering of love means that I can't pull the parachute of self-care to extract myself from that web of obligations.
We want to go with the last question.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Richard. In part three, you describe ways in which humans experience transcendence. And since time is short and we don't want to spoil the ending, can you give us some hints about how we might experience transcendence?
Yeah, we were talking this before we started recording about how this science of positive psychology it is not pointing us inward anymore. It's raising a cautionary flag about excessive introversion, excessive self-focused rumination, but it's rather pointing us towards these practices of like mindfulness or contemplative prayer. It's pointing us to encounters of wonder and awe. Nature is an example of that, where I'm encountering a reality bigger than my own. And that encounter of awe might prompt me to cosmic gratitude. Who do I say thank you to when I experience a sunset or something beautiful in nature? The spring flowers are about to come out. We're going to feel that transcendence. Who do I address thanks to? Interestingly, one of the biggest triggers of awe and wonder is what psychologists call moral beauty. That is to say, witnessing acts of love, sacrificial kindness and compassion and generosity moves our hearts in a way that even miraculous sunsets don't do. And so I was asking my students the other day, I said, do you have moral heroes? Like, do you point other people in your own life, a grandparent, or people in history that you point to and go like, man, when I hear their stories, I am just drawn into a relationship with something bigger than myself. And they struggled a little bit. I don't know if they have a pantheon of moral heroes that they look at. And I shared some of mine. But I think one of the reasons why Jesus is so compelling is because he pulls me into transcendence, right? His moral beauty, the way he moves through the world, pulls me into transcendence. But ultimately, to answer the question, I end the book with making an appeal to faith that these things just kind of can't hang out in a vacuum. Like your mattering, the cosmic gratitude, the experiences of wonder and awe, all of these things are putting spirituality and faith and a question of God out front of us. And so at the end, I gently just ask the reader to consider that to bring this full circle, you know, on the worst day of your life, where do you turn when you have nothing left and all the metrics of your superhero complexes are pointing to your worthlessness and your failure? What move do you make? And I think that's where a conversation about God shows up, that there is a voice that you hear in the quietness and the sadness of your worst day that says, You are my beloved child. You still matter. Your life still has a purpose because you know what? You don't have to do this on your own. And I think the recovery community, I don't bring this up in the book, but I'm really, the first two steps of the recovery community, I think are really, really profound. You know, like step one is like that we admit that our lives have become unmanageable and that we're helpless to fix it. Like that we come to our end and we all feel that on the worst day of our lives. Like I kind of, you know, I hit my limit and I hit my rock bottom. But then the second move is the move of transcendence. And so I've come to rely on a power greater than myself that can restore me to sanity. And I told my students this just yesterday. I was talking about this with them. And I go, look, sadly, I think if you're raised in a conservative Christian home, you think the question of God is about being a good person. Like we've so framed the conversation as moral. You know, are you a good person? You know, is God judging you? Are you going to heaven? Are you going to hell? We framed it so morally. And I told my students, I said, let me change that for you. I think the question of God is about sanity. You know, that's what's at stake in the question of God, your sanity. Because of these things I've been talking about, gratitude, joy, mattering, those are questions of health and sanity. And so the question of God shows up in that location. And so that's kind of where the book ends. Where do we encounter transcendence? I would invite readers to go to a church, to be quiet in prayer, not just to be mindful, but to listen to oneself being spoken to in a still small voice, to turn outward and encounter God.
One of the things I really appreciated, Richard, in reading the book, as a local minister in a church, you know, I'm always looking for ways to get the conversation initiated with people around me who don't know God and don't know, you know, the beauty that's found in Jesus Christ and who he is. I felt like what you've provided for us is a very good tool and conversation starter for the evangelistic mission of the church. Our listeners are believers who want to make Jesus known in our world. And so you kind of lead us to a place where you allow us to see where you have found that in your own faith. And, you know, I think the story of Miss Beth at the end would move any reader to tears and thinking about, here's a fellow human being with all that she had been through in life, finding her mattering, finding her identity in, finding grace in God. So, you know, I thank you for putting what I think is a very useful conversation starter into our hands to share with others. And to, you know, in my own thinking, I've thought this is a great book to give someone who may know nothing about God, but say, you know, this author deals with, I think, some of the issues in life we're all dealing with. Read this and let's have a conversation after and to let that lead to a conversation about faith. So I would really recommend our listeners to read it, not only I think it speaks to modern Christianity, for those who kind of go to Christian faith and say, you know, this is about either me being better or me having my best life now. It is trying to take us beyond to something much deeper and richer. So thank you for that. And again, I want to encourage our listeners to get a copy of the book, to share it with others. It is The Shape of Joy. Again, our guest and the author is Dr. Richard Beck. It is on Broadleaf Publishing. And I just want to really thank you for the book and thank you for being with us, Richard. And anything else you'd like to share? I know you're going to be back with us for our next podcast, but anything you'd like to say to kind of tie everything together and close this podcast?
No, I think, you know, this will bridge us to the conversation about our center and the work of Landon Saunders, and that in many ways I see the book, The Shape of Joy, to come alongside what you're saying. It is a way to think about evangelism in an increasingly secular post-Christian culture. Landon used joy as a way to lead into a conversation about things that really matter, conversations about God. And so, yeah, I agree. I hope the book is something that people could hand to friends and family without embarrassment, and feel like it kind of brings a person into a conversation about God in a way that is really inviting and gentle, but also compelling and beautiful. Like, I really think the first step of evangelism is to get somebody to say, I want this to be true. You know, the desire, I really want this to be true, and begin there at that motivational state. So thank you for having me. I hope the book blesses your listeners if they encounter it. Thank you for the conversation.
Well, it blessed me, and we're very appreciative. So look forward to being back with you and also having Claire back with us. We're going to talk about her work at the Saunders Center there at ACU. So before we close out, just want to say this about Common Ground Unity. We have a vision to create and support gatherings of unity-minded Christians around the globe. Imagine the good news of these gatherings modeling the prayer of Jesus in our divided world. Help us with comments and suggestions. You can email john@commongroundunity.org. And if you're benefiting and being blessed by this ministry, then we ask you to consider making a monthly donation to support the work. You can do that at www.commongroundunity.org/donate. Again, join us for the next podcast that drops. We'll further this conversation. We look forward to being back with you. Thank you for listening to the Common Grounds Unity podcast. Please check out commongroundsunity.org to learn about who we are and to find gatherings in your area. You can also subscribe to our monthly digital newsletter, join the Facebook group, or find our YouTube channel. Until next time, God bless, and remember, unity starts with a cup of coffee.